I'm really delighted to welcome David. I was at school with David, as was Tony and as was John, and I was in awe then of his guitar playing. And if you don't listen to anything else that David's done, check out Galliard, because there's some beautiful music there. But David's also put some samples up, and I will hand over to you, David.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks everyone for coming. Great to hear everyone and your interests and experience. I wasn't sure when I put the sort of schedule together whether we would be dealing with, you know, various levels of experience from beginner to experienced. Sounds to me like everybody here has got beyond the stage of choosing a guitar, so I might drop that bit. And so from what I'm getting, there's quite an interest in recording and an interest in publicizing work and getting gigs. So maybe if I focus on those three areas to kick off with. And I think, you know, I mean, I've been playing for over 40 years. So long time, knocking about in various forms and lineups. And really, I think what I might partly be doing is saying, you know, don't make the mistakes I made. and here are some interesting things that might work for you from my experience. But obviously, some of you guys are very experienced as well. So I'm really interested to compare notes with you all as well, with the experiences that you've had. Yeah.
Could I just ask you not to drop your bit on choosing a guitar, and I'll tell you why.
Oh, okay.
I have a decent-ish acoustic, but I want something better. And I actually think that's harder than getting your first guitar, because your first guitar, you don't know a thing about it. I happened to read a few things and fell quite nicely on a machine that worked for me.
Yeah.
But now it's just like a minefield. You know,
yes.
So I would like some hints on choosing maybe right. Your next guitar.
Great. Okay. Well, let's start there then. I mean, the basic survey is that guitars get better and better, and you can get a good guitar for less nowadays than you could before. I mean, there are big names, and there are sort of hierarchies of big names. I'm a bit old-fashioned. I am a Martin fan. Now, I got into guitar listening to Paul Simon, that first album, the Paul Simon songbook that he did, which was just him and a Martin OM guitar. And then I got into ragtime and blues and fingerstyle with players like Stefan Grossman and Duck Baker. And a lot of those guys use Martins. So I was imprinted on Martins from an early age. You can get a Martin for as little as £600-700 these days. And some of them are really not bad. The X series Martins, which are made of a sort of I'm going to say mahogany mashup, you know, that rather than being solid back and sides, but they have the Martin sound. I've gone with guitar with my students. I've helped choose guitars, and you know, some of those budget Martins are pretty good. If you've got over a grand to spend, then the solid wood Martins. I've got a couple now. One thing to think about is what body size you want and what neck profile. The thing that I think most people don't really talk about is neck profiles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have two Martins. They're both small body guitars. So you get your big body guitars. Jumbo is a big body with quite a big waist on it, quite a big cinch in on the waist. And they are quite good at accentuating bass and treble. Dreadnoughts, which was the Martin big guitar, they were designed back in the early 20th century, mainly for playing with bluegrass bands, and they were designed for enhanced bass because you want to cut through. You've got the mandolin and the fiddle who are bashing out the top lines, and the space that the guitar would occupy would be the bass and rhythm, bass and chords end. So these Dreadnought guitars, and I think to some extent the Jumbo as well, bigger bodies ones, are mainly for bass and volume. Now, because I'm a fingerstyle, I played those for quite a while. But for a while, I played one of those Ovation fiberglass bowl-back guitars. They were quite trendy in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I felt very modern playing an Ovation. And then, kind of in the 80s and 90s, with the advent of Taylor guitars, everybody started going back to tone woods. And suddenly it was, you know, were you going to play, you know, it was very naff to play an Ovation. And were you going to play a Koa Taylor or a Cocobolo Taylor or a Rosewood or a Mahogany? Or, and everybody got, you know, it's kind of like the way coffee and chocolate have got these days. There were so many flavors of guitar. So I play two small body guitars. One is the Martin Triple O. They both have cutaways. I do need a cutaway. I do love cutaways, which a lot of Martin people think are terrible and sacrilegious, because Martins should be, you know, fully acoustic and big and resonant. But I do love a cutaway. So I've got the Triple O with the cutaway and the OM with the cutaway. And the Triple O is a kind of light, bright sounding guitar. And the OM is exactly the same size body, but the bracing is different. So it actually sounds like a bigger guitar. It's really weird. Mm. But they have different necks. And so the OO, the Triple O I've got, has a really nice neck, like an electric. But on the OM, you get a thicker neck. And it's just that bit chunkier, and the string spacing is bigger. So there's, if I want to go fast, like if I'm playing lead guitar in a band, I will always use the Triple O. Mm. And what I use the OM for, with the you know, the sort of bigger, sturdier sound and construction, is for sort of bigger, more resonant. I mostly use that in the folk duo with Gay, my wife, and Galliard, that Peter mentioned, because I do want sort of big, resonant sounds, and I'm less interested in speed, but I might be doing big, scrunchy chord shapes where having wide string spacing is quite a good thing. So neck profile and body shape and size, I really would, you know, I would try several guitars in whatever shops you can get into, just to get used to what neck do I like. Do I like a big thick neck or a lighter, more like an electric guitar neck? Body shape, etc. As I say, Taylor were the big competitor. It always used to be Martins and Gibsons at the high end. Gibson Jumbos, J45s, J200s, great for bright strumming sounds. You know, if you strum one of those Gibson Jumbos, if you do almost nothing, if you only play three chords on it, they sound wonderful. Hummingbird, you know, stuff like that. Martins, the thing I love about the Martins, big fat bass. Big, chunky, even on a, I've got the Triple O here, and coming through the iPhone, it's not going to sound like much, and also with my totally shot strings that haven't gigged for a year, but there's a dark resonance on the bass end of a Martin. Taylor came along, and they brought in this kind of mid-size, grand auditorium size, which is somewhere between the Martin small and large bodies, which is quite a nice compromise. You get quite a nice lot of bass and quite a nice lot of brightness on the treble. And Taylor also, I think, really pushed Martin into having cutaways because they brought those in. And Taylor have a budget end called Turner, which are like the Martin X series, a pretty good under a grand acoustic guitar. I like Washburns. Never seen a bad Washburn acoustic. You get It's funny, a few years back, there were some great acoustic guitar shops on the South Coast. There was the Acoustic Music Centre in Brighton, and there was the something else Guitar Junction in Weymouth. And they had everything. They had weird little American makers like Froggy Bottom and Breed Love.
You should buy one just for the name.
Bourgeois. Really, yeah, yeah. I played a Froggy Bottom. It was weird. It was like a classical, which also Loudons. Now, Loudons was popularized really by Pierre Bensoussan when he came along with his Dadgad tunings in the 80s. And I always feel they're very sort of austere, classical sounding, very, very clean sounding guitars, and definitely worth a play.
Do you want to explain what a Dadgad tuning is, David?
Oh, yeah, sure. So it's where you tune your strings from the bottom. You tune your bottom E down to D. So it's D-A-D, G-A-D tuning. So your bottom E goes down to D, your top E goes down to D, and your B goes down to A. And a lot of folkies use that tuning. It's nice and resonant. You get lots of... you can use drones. You can use a bass D drone. You get drones on your trebles of A and D. And a lot of the finger work happens on the remaining strings. Although, obviously, also the nice thing about tuning down your top strings is it's really easy to play fast on them because they're so slack.
Mm.
They do get a bit floppy, so some people use heavier gauge strings to compensate for the floppiness. So somebody like Martin Simpson, who's a big Dadgad player, might use a 13 as his top string.
Wow.
So it doesn't crash about, and he's got nice strong hands, so he doesn't need to worry about giving himself an easy time with light strings. A lot of
have you tried two capos, partial capo?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I've got.
Have you heard of Chris Drever?
Yes. Yeah,
as I've been listening to some of Chris's stuff. Yeah,
right.
And he uses this partial capo to create Dadgad, but without detuning.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, I have done that. I don't own one, but a mate of mine from one of the bands did try that system out. I personally don't use tunings much because I've gone to a lot of trouble to learn scales in. In standard tuning, yeah. And as soon as I'm out of in a new tuning, I don't know where my scales are, and it frightens me. But yeah,
the weird thing about the partial capo thing is because you're not detuning, you've still got strings that are open, and of course, as soon as you fret anything, you're back to pretty much standard tuning in a weird sort of way.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very different to standard Dadgad.
It is, isn't it? I kept finding that I kept forgetting and going below the second cap.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
Nick Jones is another great one for tunings, isn't he? CG, CG, CD.
Oh, wow.
One of his favourite tunings.
I think Richard Thompson gets pretty keen on some of them.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah. Open G, open G minor. John Renbourn. My big hero is John Renbourn.
All right.
And he, uses open G the way slide players do, and open G minor. My favourite tune of his, Mist Covered Mountains, John Renbourn, if you can find it on YouTube. Glorious G minor tuning thing. Sorry, I just droned on for a very long time. Is there anything I didn't drone on about?
No, it's great. I mean, because obviously it's all personal taste and what you want to do with the guitar.
Absolutely.
And a friend of mine who runs a music shop here says basically you play as many as you can and one will speak to you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And that's the one you should buy.
Can I throw one in there to the mix, Steve?
Yeah, please go ahead, Steve. Yeah.
You've got your Takaminis and that as well, but
Good one.
One which I find actually is really, really good. It's one of the it's a fairly new one, not quite as expensive as the Martins and that, but really, really good sound, and that's Faith.
Yeah, yeah,
yes, totally agree. Yeah,
Well, they're made by the same people that make the Patrick, whatever his name is.
Patrick Egan. Guitars.
Yeah, Egan, aren't they? Yeah. They're made near here in Oswestry, I believe. Or they're,
really?
They're, no, they're not made here, perhaps, but they're set up and tuned and sent out from near here, which is where the Patrick, what's his name?
Egel.
Patrick Egel, yeah. So he's based near here, I believe. And obviously his guitars cost more. But the Faith ones, he kind of looks after.
Right.
They come into this country. So they go out, I think, well set up.
They all have sort of names of different planets and that.
All right.
I have one which is Faith Saturn, and then some of them have got eclipse in front of them, and that generally means that the guitar is made of a like a glossy black finish, and that, which is really, really nice.
Yeah, I've got a friend who has a weird guitar style where he plays tuned, and he calls it the octave guitar. All his strings are an octave down.
Oh wow!
So he's playing like bass and little chord fragments, and he uses a Faith Neptune, the big-bodied one. If I were playing a Faith, I'd probably go for the Venus, which is the sort of small to mid.
The smaller one,
size,
yeah.
And the Mercury one is the really small kind of parlor guitar. Yeah, I totally agree. They're lovely guitars. And again, they come in pretty much mostly under a grand, don't they, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, the Eclipse Saturn and I had, I think it was about 800.
Yeah.
But could I add another suggestion? Do you mind me?
Oh, please.
I went the other way. I went and tried a lot of different guitars, and I ended up with an old Yamaha FG-180.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's 53-year-old.
Wow.
And I sent a Loudon's, a Northern Ireland manufacturer, or were here.
Yeah.
Another crowd called McElroy here who build guitars.
Ooh,
and they put a bug in it for me. And my mate has a Loudon, but he spent about £1,600 on it. And my little Yamaha, which cost a couple of £100, put a bug in, blows it out of the water. sometimes you can get what I, and it's beaten up, and it's like myself. It was once lovely, but it's probably a very awful looking.
Yeah.
But people who sit down and play it just say, where did you get that from?
How long have you had it, Roy?
Yeah.
I've had this one about 20 years.
You see, I bet if you put it on eBay now, it wouldn't be as cheap as that, because people have realized those older Yamahas are really nice.
Yeah, I have a 260. I have a 12-string 260, which is Willard Dreadnought body as well, I picked up.
Mm.
And, there's something about the old wood that isn't in the new sounds. And I'm not an expert by any sense. That's what I was saying. If you may try different things out, you'll find something that is like a glove. And I found this one and I thought, goodness.
The Yamahas certainly are a really nice guitar. I had an old, I think it was an F300 or something like that. I can't remember the model, but beautiful sound. One of the Compass ones.
Yeah.
Yamaha Compass. It was a gorgeous guitar.
Mm.
Yeah. I'm interested you mentioned the bug sound, because that is a whole new area as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you know what the bugs in your respective, yours and your mate's guitars are?
Right? I have no idea what the pal's Loudon is. The one I got put in was by, apparently it's a little Frenchman, works for McElroy's in County Antrim, and he put a wee bug in it just. He put it in through the little bit at the back where the
strap mounting,
and put it through inside there. And it's, I have no idea. I've never asked. I just thought, wow. And the fellas who actually got the work done for me, the boys in the shop said, you're mad spending money on that. And when it came back with new strings and that on it and they started playing it, they would let it go.
What's a bug? I'm being the jargon policeman here. I don't.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Pickup to you, Pete.
So the pickup that you amplify with, there are various sorts. Now, I'll talk about the ones I know about. On the Martins, my cheaper Martin had the cheaper Fishman, which was a Premier. And on that one, they hack the body, they hack a hole in the body, and you've got a preamp block built in with a battery in it and all your controls, you know, volume and three-band graphic and your feedback buster, etc. On the more expensive Martin, because they don't like to knock holes in expensive, in the more expensive ones, it all fits inside the sound hole, but you've still got a battery and controls. But on that one, you've got a digital emulation of mic positionings. And I would have to say that that pickup was better on the OM. The Fishman Aura Ellipse was better than the Fishman Premier. They work in different ways. You have the transducer type pickup, which picks up the vibration of the body and turns it into electrical impulses. You have the piezoelectric, which has a strip of piezoelectric crystals which fit under the bridge where the strings go over, under the nut, I should say, on the bridge, which generates signals that way. They are a bit quacky and nasal sounding. Transducer is a bit more like a microphone, and the downside of them is they can be boomy and bangy. They can, if you hit the guitar, they will pick it up. And you do get proper, you know, like microphonic pickups, which that is even more the case. And then you get blend systems, which, as the name suggests, will give you two different types of pickup and will blend the signals. Now, what I find on the blend systems is that very often, if you're playing in a small venue and you have the option of blending your sort of piezo signal with your mic signal, quite often, as soon as you put the mic in, you get feedback.
Yeah.
If you're right on top of the PA, and I almost always have my blends jammed to the piezo, so there's not much point in having the mic. The I-beam system, the LR Bags I-beam, is the one that my guitar tech, I think one or two of us on the list, I think Steve, you were mentioning you've got a good tech. I've got a good tech as well, who's an excellent acoustic guy. He doesn't do much on electrics, but he knows his acoustics, and he's a big fan of the I-beam. That mix is I think it's a microphonic and a transducer. And the thing I like about it is it doesn't have that piezo quack to it. It's a more mellow sound, and it will pick up the old bang on the top, but it's pretty good. Those obviously have to be fitted inside the guitar. Some systems, you get these in the sound hole systems.
Yeah.
Fishman used to do one of those, which again has electric pickups, electromagnetic pickups, but it also has a little mic on board, and LR Bags do a similar system so that you can fit those, put them on, take them off. Although ideally you want to find the sweet spot and keep it. I've got one guitar, a nylon string jazz guitar, which has a shirtless system. They're a Swiss make, and that is pretty darn good, particularly at rendering the nylon string tone. And that, again, is a blend system of a transducer and a microphone. But again, I use much more of the transducer. Soon as you put microphones in, if you're anywhere near a speaker, I do find I get feedback. I did try, here's the weirdest system. A friend of mine, in fact, the same guy who has the octave guitar, has a friend who is a metal worker, and he built for each of us a mic mount that screwed on the guitar and it enabled us to put a gooseneck with a mic on the guitar and have the mic up against the sound hole. And I found a Chinese mic that had quite low feedback, called a Bardl, B-A-R-D-L. And I could actually do a gig with that and get a lovely acoustic sound. But it was such a pain having this big, heavy mic mounted on the guitar that I gave up doing it. And I went back to just using the onboard system. But they do make a big difference. As I say, the I-beam is, or the Schertler, those are probably my two favourite systems, but those Fishman and LR Bags sound hole ones are pretty highly rated as well.
I feel the need to interject at this point.
Yes.
Okay, I've come upstairs and I'm running through my mixer now, so I can hear you a little clearer.
Okay.
On my lap right now, I have a Yamaha with a retrofitted pickup. A friend of mine is a guitar tech, and he put that in for me for a few hundred pounds. It's got a simple tone and volume wheel, I guess you call them, in the top of the acoustic hole.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think it sounds as if that's I've inadvertently stumbled across something that's quite popular, and it does sound rather nice.
Oh, it's good.
I get the same thing when I go to open mics. People are always interested in the guitar. You know, where did you get that? And you know, I said, you know, it's a sort of a, you know, it's a retrofitted, so that's why it's, and that again is the guitar that goes into the strap on the bass.
Great.
You're all very good boys. I have to congratulate you now as a sound engineer. My absolute nightmare is people who turn up with acoustics without any kind of pickup whatsoever. At which point I've got to rig up some kind of mic and try and stop the feedback from my end, of course, and get a decent enough sound. It's not so bad if it's just an open mic, but if it's a flipping band or something, it's an absolute nightmare.
And if it's a blind guitarist, he bangs the guitar on the mic.
Well, he does, because he won't keep still. Yeah. You have to tie them down if they're blind.
Yeah, I have been that guitarist.
I fitted my own. That was fun.
Oh, superb.
I took a drill to my Yamaha, which is quite scary, but I did it anyway. And then I drilled the little tiny, because I've got one of the Piezo ones. Sorry, Dave. it actually works rather well on my Yamaha for some reason. I don't quite know why. Yeah. So the worst bit, the most difficult bit was making the nut thinner, because obviously the cable raises the nut up quite, you know, several millimeters.
Yeah,
Which you don't want, obviously.
No.
So yeah, filing that down was probably the most nerve wracking bit of the whole thing, really.
Yeah.
Although I know they're pretty damn cheap if you actually did damn it, you know, go too far or something. I know they're pretty cheap to get a new nut, but still, it's still nerve wracking.
Yeah, respect.
But it seems to work, so that's good.
Great.
And mine has no controls whatsoever, which is a sound engineer's dream, really.
Right.
Guitarists can't start playing with it, you see, in the middle of the gig. Because they kind of go through the gig and their ears get a bit battered and they start thinking, oh, I could do the bit more treble. And they slap it up because they think it's just going to work in their monitors, or they don't think at all. I don't know which. And then, of course, it changes the sound in front of house. And I'm going, what's going on here?
I'm in the guilty corner again.
Yeah, I know.
Which is
know.
Partly why I got the ones with the preamp. But in fact, I had to replace the Fishman on my the OM. And I decided I wouldn't have any gubbins except the preamp on the guitar.
Yeah.
And it's an LR Bags system. And I already had an LR Bags DI box, which gives me 5-band graphic.
Oh, wow.
And so I put the OM through that. And that is a lovely sound. Mm. But of course, a sound man's nightmare, because I do fiddle with it in the course of proceedings. So
I just hide it. I get you to make sure it sound you're happy with it at the beginning, and then I'll hide the box, you see, so you can't reach it.
Yeah, just what I deserve. So yeah. So, any more on guitars and acoustics and amplifying? Did anybody want to do electric guitars at this point?
Not me.
Nope.
Happy with whatever you want to do.
Let's stick with acoustics. So, shall we talk about? Who's got the time? I've lost my watch.
15:36.
Righty ho, thanks. Because I want to do. We got recording to do, and we got gigs to do, and have we got? Oh, that's okay, isn't it?
Recording seems to be an obvious follow-on, doesn't it?
Okay, well, let me. Now, I'm very aware that we have, for example, Steve with us, who's put some fantastic recordings into the Dropbox, and is a great Reaper whiz, which I'm not. So I'll talk about bit and Peter as well, and probably everybody here is better at Reaper and stuff than I am. But I'll talk about my feelings and my experience, and then I'm sure people will have stuff to contribute. So opinions vary for a start. I'll talk about mics first of all. Let's start at the front end of the procedure. Some people say record a guitar with small diaphragm mics, pencil mics. And I have always liked adding to those a larger diaphragm mic. And it just happened. When Gay and I did our first recordings, we recorded with a guy called Mike Westergaard, who was trained as a studio engineer with a guy whose name I can't remember, but he recorded the Rolling Stones. So he was a good person. And Mike was the keyboard player in a band called The Blessing, who were in the charts in the 80s, I gather. I wasn't listening to the charts by then. I was already an old fogey by the time he was in the charts. But yeah, he was a great engineer. He's the best engineer I've ever worked with. And he learned this technique from this guy. And he had a pair of pencil mics at right angles, you know, stereo right angle pair in front of me. And then he put a larger diaphragm mic over my shoulder. And I loved the sound that he got from that. I've also recently done some recording with a guy.
Did he also tie you still?
Well, there is that. I think that they were just about far enough away for me not to clock them. The main problem I had was the main problem I always have recording is how you stop the headphone lead falling onto your strings at some vital point in the proceedings. I'm always threading headphone mics behind my back and under the stool if I can. But
so tuck them in the loop at the back of your trousers, yeah.
Yes, good thought, yeah, yeah. So, but I love that. And so I do always like to have the stereo pair plus the big the big diaphragm mic just seems to capture some bass that the pair of small mics doesn't. I recently bought a pair of Rode NT5s, which I've seen highly recommended. And whenever I've recorded with Rodes in other people's studios, I have been really impressed with them. And I read an interview with a guitarist who's quite big on Spotify, whose name I can't remember, who does all his recording at home using those. A lot of people use AKGs. What are they? Are they 454s or
545s?
451s, thanks. Yeah,
the pencils, one.
So that's I do like a bit of extra bass. You get the thing about where to position them. As I say, might use the right angle pair. Some people, they say you don't put them in front of the sound hole because there's too much sound. Some people like to put one around the 12th or 14th fret and one around the bridge for that reason, so that the mic, I think this sort of idea that I never quite understood it, but I think you get more of the boxiness of the guitar sound if you're right opposite the sound hole. I think that's the thinking, but I'm sure people here can.
Well, yeah. I would say that I think what you're trying to do is what you're always trying to do, I think, with a lot of recording is mimic a sound that you hear with your ears from a distance from the instrument.
Yeah.
And as you get closer to any instrument, you focus in on different bits of the sound of that instrument. And it's not what you're actually hearing in the room with the ambience and so on. So somehow you're struggling as an engineer to sort of get that back if you're looking for a natural sound, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I think you're right. So picking up that, if you've got three tracks and one of them is somewhere around the 12th, 14th fret, which is a very mellow sound indeed. Mm. And then the sharpness of the bridge, and then maybe the over-shoulder thing too, which of course has got a bit more distance. And a lot of engineers will put a mic 3 or 4 feet away if it's a decent room, you know, and use that in a separate track as well, and mix some of that in as an ambient.
Yep.
And so, you know, whatever trick you can play to make the guitar sound like you're listening to it rather than you've got your face in it, which nobody ever does.
Absolutely.
I guess it's a bit... Yeah, same with drums, really.
Yeah, and a bit like recording a cab, recording an electric guitar with the mic slightly offset from the centre of the cab.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it very much depends on the room as well you're in. As to how much of that sort of shenanigan you can do. Because obviously if you've got a lot of background noise, you can't do that. You have to close mic and do what you can. But if you've got a nice quiet room, you can pull back a bit and do some of that ambient miking.
Yeah. So, I mean, otherwise, I must admit, I've always worried about putting out albums recording at home. I've always gone to a pro studio, and that's, you know, a lot of that is to do with worrying about. I always feel I never spent enough on mics. You know, you go to a studio, then they're going to have like a £2,000 Neumann or whatever. They're going to have the proper mics. I've never really splashed out on mics. And that may also have to do with my feeling that I'm not, you know, a skilled engineer. So I'm not sure how much I trust my own abilities in that department.
Mm.
And also, it is stressful recording yourself if you're the engineer. Until this list introduced me to Reaper, which I'm very grateful for, I was a click counter. I've got a Fostek 16-track digital studio I've had since about 2003, and it's quite wearing to use.
Yeah.
You know, I can get okay results with it, but actually being the engineer, you know, I am stressed enough when I'm recording. So... It swings around about, isn't it? Because it's quite nerve-wracking going to a studio and thinking, time is money, I'm paying for this.
Mm.
Whereas at home, you can relax. You can take all day doing a track. You can take all week doing a track, getting the perfect take, etc. But you do have the stress of doing the recording as well. So it's a lot is down to how confident you are, I guess, as your own engineer. And
I think you've sort of hit it on the head.
Sorry?
Yeah, you've pretty much hit it on the head there, Dave. I mean, the problem that I find, certainly with the digital recorders, I mean, I've had a couple as well. I've had a couple of Boss ones. I've had a Fostex as well. And doing the recording is okay. You can get the results. You can... get a track recorded, you can do some basic sort of panning and levels and that. But then when you want to get into the nitty-gritty and the production of it, you find it very, very difficult to try and manipulate tracks that have been recorded in one of those digital recorders. So that was one of the reasons why I went for a sort of software-based thing. And in the beginning, I went for... Cakewalk.
Sonar.
And that was okay. It sort of introduced me to some basic principles, but even with that, even with the scripts and that, you were still quite restricted. But when I moved on to Reaper, I mean, my goodness, that just completely opened up the whole world of post-production to me.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question on about that? What is a good idea? Are you better to go with a mixing desk or to look for something like a Roland interface to record?
The age-old debate. I'll stick a 10p's worth in if you like to start with.
Go for it.
As a live My engineering career, such as it is primarily live work. And being blind, I'm very much used to analog mixing desks. And I love the immediacy of a mixing desk. So you've got everything in front of you, knobs and buttons. you turn something, something happens. You move a fader, something happens. You don't have to think about keystrokes or, God forbid, mice or, you know, or anything else. You've just got this surface in front of you that does stuff when you move things. And I absolutely love it. Now, for recording as well, you've got the advantage for me anyway of zero latency monitoring. So if you feed your headphones from the mixing desk, for example, you can probably record, well, you can record yourself direct. So you're hearing what's coming into the desk in your monitors, and then it goes off to be recorded. So there's no latency. There's no slight echo from the computer. It hasn't got to travel to the computer and travel back. So that's another an advantage. And if you're recording with other people, you can probably really easily make more than one headphone mix if you've got a mixing desk. Obviously, it depends on the desk. You know, that you can get desks from £50 to £5,000 and more. Mm. You know, so it's completely dependent on the desk and the facilities on that desk. But I love to have a mixing desk. I have one because I have a PA, so I've got a lovely desk, which is by a firm called Midas, and it's just gorgeous. And of course, you've got EQ on there. What I haven't got on mine is any effects or anything because they're all external. The advantage of an interface, I think, is that A, they're small, generally small. You'd struggle to get one bigger than one rack unit, I would imagine. So just a flat box. You can have any number of channels, really, depending on what you want. So if you're happy, you know, if you need a couple in, a couple out, that's absolutely fine. You can do that. If you need 16 or more because you want to record other people or whatever, you can do that too. And they'll plug into your computer, you know, probably USB these days. Let's not even go there. And you can select on your recording software where the sound's coming from and so on. They do have control panels often, which can be quite inaccessible, software control panels. And, you know, some of those will give you zero latency monitoring as well, but you haven't got anything like the facilities you've got on a desk. So I think it's pros and cons, really.
Yeah, I must admit, I've still... Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, David. You're show mate, sorry.
I've started using... I use, and I think I'm not alone in using the Focusrite. I use a 2i2, but I've started using a mixer into that.
Right.
I think this mixer must have... I don't know whether it's got better preamps or what, but it does seem to deliver a nice, clear, loud signal. And the 2i2 isn't so bad because you don't need to do extra stuff. The more channels you have with Focusrite, the more you need to use the software, it becomes a problem. Somebody on this list has recommended a Behringer because it has pushable buttons. Now, was that Tim who recommended that? Tim Pellick? Somebody recommended that.
I think it might have been Tim. Because I myself, like you, Dave, I think I would have certainly recommended the 2i2 because that's what I have. I think using the sound card in conjunction with a mixer gives you the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about my desk, obviously it's reasonably expensive, but it's actually FireWire, but it could just as easily have been a USB version. It's got, you know, you can switch the signal to wherever you want pretty much without too much software control. So that's really nice.
Yeah.
And obviously, I am primarily a drummer, so I do look at multi-channel stuff. you know, recording a band is a whole different thing to recording one person, I think.
Well, I must admit, it suddenly occurred to me while I'd got the 2i2 that I couldn't do my 3-microphone recording with it.
That's true. I didn't think
about that until I actually mainly got it. It all happened rather nicely, actually. It's one of those sort of beneficial spin-offs of lockdown, if you like, that I got the interface originally at that time in lockdown. Do you remember we were all scrambling to find stuff we could jam together on?
Yeah.
You know, like Jamulus Jamcasm. And we were all trying out Zoom and FaceTime and finding out there was too much latency. And so I got that originally with the view of collaborating online with it. Mm. And literally, as soon as I bought the interface, people started talking about Reaper on Vibe. And I thought, hey, there are more uses for this interface than I realized. So
absolutely.
Worked out.
Did you ever do any live jamming?
No, I still haven't. I really must get Jamulus, because Sarah and Andrew, you were talking about, you've got set up with Jamulus now, haven't you? And I was thinking I must do that, but I haven't done it yet.
Because Andre Lewis posted some stuff about it, didn't he? He seemed to be quite impressed with it. And if it's impressing him, it's probably quite good, I think.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
He's got a server as well, hasn't he?
And
I think Tim Penick's set up a server as well.
Right. It would be fun to try. I haven't
tried
it. It would
be worth a go, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I have gone as far as putting a wire into my laptop, as is for internet access. So I'm not using wireless. Because that's one of
good stuff. Yeah,
one of the things they recommend, isn't it?
Yeah,
the wireless signal just puts latency into the loop.
Yeah, true.
But I haven't got any further than that.
any other interface recommendations?
There are so many, aren't there? There are probably as many interfaces as there are desk manufacturers. So Presonus, I've got a lovely Presonus interface, which has got two channels of Valve mics,
Valve inputs,
which makes a little bit of extra flavour.
It does, yeah.
The other one that was recommended recently on the list was SSL, and they've just brought out some new ones with very nice knob and button controls, apparently. So I'd love to see some of those.
Yes.
Yes, I was trying to remember that. I remember somebody, it was on the list, wasn't it? It might have been you who put it there, Peter. And I couldn't think what it was called. Yes, thanks. So, has that covered recording? Has anyone got...
It's a whole nother session, isn't it? So I think that was a very good summary for the purposes of this one.
Great. So, I mean, one thing I would say, thinking about songwriters getting their songs out and people getting gigs, I would just put in a little word for spending as much as you can on that part of it. One little niggle in my life, when we started recording, I spent a long time researching, and I've tracked down the studio through an interview in a guitar magazine. I researched about getting CDs made. So when we got it mastered, I went to a company that did mastering. I went to a company that did glass master pressing of the CDs instead of just CD-ROM burning. And we were pretty careful the artwork could probably have been better, actually. But with the demos, we had our demos professionally, you know, factory produced, and we did get a very good response. You know, if I sent a demo to a club, they would say, your demo was professional. You know, I get all these demos with paper labels on, and yours was clearly printed, and, you know, you spent the time on it. The first CD we got a play on Radio 2 from, and I'm convinced, again, that that was because we had put money into the production. Not a huge lot of money, but maybe a couple of thousand to make that.
Yeah.
And since then, I've worked with a lot of people who would like And then, you know, we got quite a bit of airplay on local stations as well. We, you know, presenters ringing us up and saying, you know, nice stuff. We got reviewed in a lot of the, at that time. I mainly play jazz now, and that music is sort of folk with a modern jazz twist. We got a lot of nice reviews in the folk press, and I think spending the money on production values just gave us. I mean, I like to think that the music was good too. People were kind about it, but I do actually think the problem I've had with bands I've worked subsequently with. I've done three albums with a very good singer songwriter, which is the band that Clive Lever also plays in, and Ron is an excellent singer songwriter, but he always did cheap albums. They were always produced on his agent's computer, They always
had cheap.
too many tracks on them. Well, yeah, because he always recorded them in cheap studios. So, I mean, we didn't do much in the way of... The last album we did, the third album, I tried to get a bit of control over, and we did multi-tracking rather than live recording. And we used more session players. And I was rather happier with the sound we got on that. But really, it's the same. The band I'm playing with mostly now is Gypsy Jazz Ska Band. They've got quite big ambitions, and they get quite a lot of gigs.
Yeah.
But they don't put the professionalism into the recordings. So they don't, and they don't also go to the bother of sending them out to get reviews or sending them out to radio stations, whatever. Obviously, CD is less of a thing now than it was then, but it's the thing I feel quite strongly about, that in a way my first recording was my most successful because subsequently I haven't had control of the production and the distribution. And so that was the CD I said in my write-up. I got onto a distributor and they sent some boxes over to Japan, and apparently we got quite a nice review in Japanese, which we don't understand, but somebody told us it was a good one. And I do feel quite strongly about this, that a lot of musicians don't, they kind of put out a Heath Robinson, a hopeful version of something, without actually doing the research and doing the work and
like a demo, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I agree with you completely. Even if it's not CD, it's crucial now that you have stuff online.
Yeah,
and it's the quality is still matters to me anyway, just as much. If it sounds poor, then it sounds poor. It doesn't matter whether it's on a CD or a cassette or vinyl or whatever. It sounds poor. And, I think that matters.
Yeah. Gypscaz have got their two albums on iTunes, so that is around. I keep meaning to try and get some of the Galliard stuff on iTunes, but I haven't got around to it. It would be a sort of retrospective. We did three albums as Galliard, and I quite fancy the idea of doing a 25th anniversary best of Galliard thing online, but I haven't got around to it yet.
Can you spell Gypscaz for us?
Oh, yeah, it's GYP, as in Gypsy, SKA, as in Scar, and ZZ, as in Jazz. GYP, SKA, ZZ. And it has the merit of being made up of being the only Gypscaz on the whole of the internet.
Awesome.
Whereas if you Google David Ray, you get a man who's an expert in luminous aphids, which I thought would be a great band name, actually. I do want to start a band called the Luminous Aphids.
Not the best occupation for a blind person.
Well, no. Where are my aphids?
But it is a good band name, actually, Luminous
Aphids. Yeah, I think so. So you're getting stuff online. I quite like the idea of CD Baby, because I still rather like CDs, and they will get your CD. They will sell your CD for you, and they will also get you digital distribution. But Gypscaz used DistroKid to get their albums online. And there are various ways of getting it on now. There is a package called Amuse, which I think we used DistroKid for our first album and Amuse for our second album. The DistroKid has a yearly £20, I think it is. Actually, it was Andre on this list who put me onto them. But Amuse is free, I gather. So we use that for our second album. But yeah, I, as I say, because this applies to gigging as well, as I say, for demos as well as for albums, if you're looking at getting gigs. But also, yeah, online. Put it on SoundCloud, put it on YouTube. Have your own website is the thing that most people say. I always feel slightly grandiose saying to people, go to daveray.com, as if I was a big famous person. But actually, it's so much easier. I used to have one called Grasshopper Promotions, which had all the bands that I played with on it. And then I started playing with a guy, Canadian guitarist, who had his own website, Jamie_Moore.com. And I could tell that everybody was more impressed with his JamieMoore.com than they were with my GrasshopperPromotions.com. So I thought, right, I've got to get a .com. And it's really not a lot more expensive.
No. It's also, and presumably if you were getting radio play and so on, you'd done all the ISRC codes and that sort of stuff.
Oh, that's the other thing. Yes. Yeah. I mean, doing your MCPS.
Yeah.
Paying your royalties. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yes.
Because that's important, isn't it? You know, if it feels like a hell of a lot of work to do if nothing much is happening. But if suddenly something explodes and you start getting played somewhere.
Yeah.
They have the ability to collect money on your behalf, don't they?
Absolutely,
That's what they're there for.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it all looks pretty, you know, a lot better if that starts to happen.
Yes.
Not that it's happened to me, but...
we had trouble because Chips Gaz do a version of Rodrigo's guitar, you know, the Adagio from the Rodrigo Concerto. Yeah. And they didn't bloody do the MCPS.
Oh.
So Spotify cut up rough about it.
Oh, wow.
So
even something that old? Wow.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, it must. Well, actually, maybe it wasn't Rodrigo. Maybe it was. There were a couple of other covers on there. It might have been something that's more recent. But yeah. Actually, Rodrigo, he only died in about 1970, 80, something like that.
Right.
So it's in its 70 years.
Yes.
So his estate still get money on that.
Mm hmm.
So, yeah, so there's PRS for your songwriting copyright. There's PPL if you're a musician on a recording, as long as the person you're recording with is professionally enough to fill in the PPL forms, then you musicians can get paid for the stuff that you play on. You know, the whole lot of that, which is worth doing. Because, you know, if you don't do it, it makes you look like small league, you know.
So and definitely, if someone was talking before about writing songs and trying to get them played by other people, famous or otherwise.
Absolutely.
If you do that, you really should be a member of PRS.
Yes.
Because that song's your song. And if you can claim the rights to it, then you should be credited if somebody else uses it. And you should collect money if anybody else makes money from it.
Yeah. I was just going to jump in there. It was me that said that.
Yeah.
Is that costly or?
I think if I remember rightly, the Performing Rights Society was £50 or something like that. But it was for life, wasn't it? It wasn't a yearly thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So you pay it once, and you're on their books.
Right, and then you can just add songs that you've written.
Yes.
Is that how it works?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
That's something.
And the other thing you can do, I don't know whether Dave's going to mention this, is. As a songwriter, as anybody who's got sort of stuff that's your own, that's not covers, you can start talking to the people who place music for, you know, anything, films, TV, games, anything like that. There are whole companies. One that springs to mind is Syncr, S-Y-N-C-R. And that's all they do. They have lots of music, and they hike it around to people, and they know who needs what. And, you know, they get music placed.
Music Gateway is another one.
Yep. So you could end up, you know, with your song as the theme tune to Hollyoaks or something like that, you know. Unlikely, but it does happen. It happens to somebody, you know.
Yeah. Once
they hear your stuff and they know what you've done, you know, you get it demoed or whatever you do with it, they know what sort of music you've got. And if the rights are all yours, they're very happy about that sort of thing because they've got no conflicts then. Shut up. My phone's making a noise. you know, they will push your music as much as they can, as well as everybody else's, of course.
Yep. Obviously you can get agents and managers who will do that, but you'll have to pay them. And some of these, I mean, certainly Music Gateway, reckon that they don't take any money off you. They are probably advertising or something, isn't it? I don't know whether, or maybe they get it from, yeah, I'm not sure.
Maybe they get paid from the people looking for the music. I don't know.
It could be, yeah, yeah.
But yeah,
I imagine there's an agent fee there.
But there are companies like that, and it's definitely worth it because it's one way of getting your stuff out there.
The other thing that people are doing these days, I don't know if you do streaming, you know, Spotify, Deezer, things like that, is to find somebody who puts together playlists of music like yours.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you do, well, what style of songs what genre would you say you're mainly in?
Me, is that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I would say sort of modern, people like Passenger and Ed Sheeran, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so if you find people who put together lists with people like you in them, then you can point them to your tracks, put some stuff online, put them on your SoundCloud or whatever, and send them links to those and say, you know, you seem to like this kind of music. It's quite depressing, isn't it? But marketing these days, you really do have to think who you are like. Mm. Who do you sound like? Mm. And you can be pretty broad about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, you know, just anybody who might like. I mean, I used to say, as I said, John Renbourn was my big hero. So I would say all these fingerstyle guys, John Renbourn. Pentangle was a big influence on Gay and me, doing the jazz folk kind of thing. So we used to mention them. But there are other people. There's a whole bunch of people doing jazz folk crossover. Nobody's ever heard of them, but yeah, if you have an idea of who they are, it's the same with CD Baby. You know, wherever you place your music, they're going to want to know, well, what is it like? Who are the people who are going to like what you do?
Yeah.
Okay, so what have we not yet covered? Anybody?
You said in your write-up, David, you're going to talk about resources. I've done a lot of scouring. I know I'd like to mention a couple I've come across myself. These are mainly for really detailed sort of note-by-note lessons, basically. Yeah. So Jerry's Guitar Bar is one pretty good one. I think my current favourite is justinguitar.com. And there's another one which I've not used for a while, but it's pretty good, which is licklibrary.com.
Ah, I love Lick Library. Yeah, yeah. I've been a member for more years than I can remember. I must admit, I've seen references to those other two, but I've never used them. But brilliant. No, thanks for those. I'll give them a check out. But yeah, Lick Library, amazing. Because you're always worried, aren't you, that you'll get a DVD and they'll... I got an Yngwie Malmsteen one, and it was mainly him I rather got the feeling it was him saying, hey, look, you know, look how very much faster than you I can play. And I'm not really going to tell you how I'm doing it. And I discovered that there was, to be fair to him, there was tab with it. But of course, that was tab I couldn't read.
Yeah.
But actually, all the Lick library lessons I have ever looked at, they tell you, you know, which finger they're putting on which string and on which fret. Mm-hmm. Absolutely marvellous.
Mm. Yeah.
Jerry's Guitar Bar is pretty much like that as well.
Right, and are those videos as well?
Jerry's Guitar, all three sites, I mentioned, they're all video-based, yeah.
Yeah, great. Jerry's Guitar Bar and
yeah, if you just bung that into Google and justinguitar.com, he's got thousands of both song lessons and theory, techniques, licks, all sorts of stuff for acoustic and electric.
Yeah, fantastic. Is that a Jerry with a G or a J?
J, I think.
Great, thanks.
There's a couple of YouTube channels as well, Marty's Guitar and Jen's Guitar, and they're very, very descriptive.
I think it very much depends just on people's individual style, doesn't it? Because I've certainly looked up songs on YouTube, how to play them, and the lesson is fine, but all they've done is put a nice high-resolution camera over, on his left hand so you can see what he's doing. And he kind of talks you through it, but it doesn't actually say anything that's useful enough to you as a blind person, really.
Yeah.
Whereas some people just seem to describe
the two that
these
I
things
mentioned,
really well.
Marty's and Jen, they tell you, you know, what position to play in, what fingers were.
Yeah. So I'd say the same about the three sites I mentioned as well.
That's what you need, isn't it?
Very detailed.
Has anybody ever looked at jamtracks.com?
No.
They exist.
Seen it, but not indeed.
Yeah, I'm meaning to check them out. So if anybody else want to check them out, I know they have one of my favourite players at the moment, Alex Hutchings, on that site. But I don't know what their lessons are like. It's funny, don't you always go through life with a few things that you've been meaning to check out and you've never looked at. But yeah, definitely. I mean, I think those are just, it was probably only really, well, the other thing I was going to mention was, and I'm sure people are onto these, but the YouTube channels of all the music stores, I just find fantastically useful. So Anderton's, PMT, Guitar, and Bach's Music all have YouTube channels, and I have my YouTube app set to all notifications from all those stores.
Wow.
And they're just constantly pumping stuff out. Really good reviews.
I'm the captain.
Yeah.
Awesome.
How do you spell Bach's?
I love those. Okay, B-A-X.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Anderson's is the best. They're really my favourite.
They are good.
Yeah, and they're fun, aren't they? The way they have that, the captain and Danish Pete and the captain and Chappers and all that stuff. And they do. They have a load of gear. They've just got everything. They've done one of the. I didn't know if we were going to talk about the high tech range, but they do. They do things like they'll compare the Headrush and the Kemper and the Lion and the Helix and the Axe FX and whatever, you know, just go through them all. But and I think they do the best job. They're not terribly good at, you know, this button does this thing, but they have a really annoying bit on some of them where they do a blindfold test. So the guitarist who's trying out the pedal is not being told what they are, and the people watching the screen can see them, but you and me don't have a clue until they get to the next part of the video. They do sometimes tell you where the blindfold bit ends, so you can scroll through to the bit where they're Well, that's all right. I'm chucking my phone around here. Yeah, they will sometimes say, if you want the post blindfold bit, go to 23 minutes or whatever, because they are quite long. But yeah, you can pick up a lot about gear from those. As I say, Anderton was probably the best. PMTV UK, that's probably my second favourite. The others, Guitar, and Bax Music, BAX, don't do quite so many, and they don't tend to be quite as show busy either. Not quite as. I tell you what, actually, if you're looking for tasty acoustics, I've just discovered a Dutch YouTube channel. They speak in English, glad to say, called The Fellowship of Acoustics, TFOA. And they are constantly getting very tasty acoustic guitars in and demoing them on a Friday afternoon on YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's rather fun. There's a load of good jazz people as well. Anyone who's into jazz, Jens Larsen is an excellent guy. And there's also a channel by a sax player and guitar duo called Jazz Duets, who are excellent. And also there's, you may have probably better known, there's Learn Jazz Standards, which is run by a guitarist. But there's also a very good podcast called The 10-Minute Jazz List. And he's not a guitarist. I think he's a sax player. But they're very good, and they're only 10 minutes. And there's, you always get something good in 10 minutes. So those are my favourite listening at the moment.
Oh,
there's
great,
too much.
You.
Okay, so that was some resources. Anything else? How are we doing for time?
It's 4:20, and there's really no fixed end. So you know, if you think you've covered everything, you can call it a day. But if people have questions, or if you know, you're welcome to carry on.
I'm just wondering. We've not done a lot about live. And I'm aware Sarah and Andrew were talking about live. So is that still a thing?
Yes, definitely.
Interested in? Because, I mean, I feel, you see, that I want to encourage people to be more adventurous. I have kind of got more adventurous as the time has gone by. But when I started out, I was in a duo with my wife, which was very convenient because I didn't have to go and schmooze people and I didn't have to convince them that I wouldn't fall off the stage or break my guitar or my amp. You know, so that was a very, as a blind person, that was quite an easy format to go into. And I kind of, as I say, I feel I wasn't brave enough in a way. I only worked initially with people who invited me. So there was a place we used to play, club we played, and a band in that club invited me to sit in with them. And the guitarist asked me for lessons, so that was, I had a good bond with them, and they were nice people, and so then I started playing with them. And this guy Ron, who invited Clive and me to join the band. Again, we were playing in all the same, in some of the same clubs, and he, you know, was putting together a band, and he liked what we did on our respective instruments. So that's how that band got together. And it was ages before I went for an audition, which was this band Gypscaz. And now, of course, everybody advertises on Facebook. There are loads of sites. Everyone will have in their own county or town a, you know, musician's site. Kent has loads of them. And that's true for selling gear, buying and selling gear as well. So There used to be a website called kentgigs.com where I found Gypscare's advertising, and they put up a video, and I thought, well, I reckon I can handle that. So I pointed them to my SoundCloud, and they said, oh, yeah, that's we like that. So I didn't. The thing that always used to terrify me was the thought of, you know, it's bad enough walking into a room of people you don't know when you can't see, but walking into a room of people you don't know with a guitar and an amplifier, I just always chickened out. I never went that step until, you know, this point where I had stuff online that I could point people to. And then when we got to that point, I said, oh, by the way, guys, I'm blind, but, you know, I've been playing for, yeah, whatever it was, 30 years by the time I joined them.
Yeah.
And they said, okay. And in fact, before that, with the Kent Gigs site, when I finally decided that I wasn't getting what I wanted out of playing with the band that I joined by invitation, and I wanted to stretch out a bit, I started ringing people up, and I started saying, actually, look, okay, so we've established that I play the kind of stuff you play, but now tell me what you think about this. And it was very interesting. There were plenty of people who would say, oh, no problem, mate. You know, one guy said, my favourite guitarist is Dot Watson. Why am I going to worry about you being blind? I thought, wow, hey, I should have done this a long time ago. But some people didn't. You know, some people say, well, we do on-stage choreography. How are you going to hack that? And I said, I'm not. I'm out of here. You know, can't do that. but, you know, as I say, it may be that you've all done this way before me. So people here may have been ahead of me. I'm ahead of me here. But as I say, I am aware that I have let visual impairment maybe hold me back. And I've found that really there are ways around it. And I wish now that I'd been bolder in putting myself about and being in more bands.
From a practical point of view, Dave, how have you coped with, and this may be, you know, appropriate for some of the other guys on this meeting as well, but how have you coped with, you know, operating equipment live, you know, things
like
changing effects or something like that, or have you tried to keep your sort of set to a minimum where you don't have to do a lot of changes or whatever?
Definitely that. Yeah. But tip number one is when the feedback starts, turn off your amplifier because everybody will think it's the blind guy and it's the guitarist. And so the first thing you do is turn your amp off when the feedback starts. And when they say, Dave, you say, my amp is off. The feedback is you. Feedback is somebody else. That's my number one tip. But yeah, absolutely. I know we've talked on the group about multi-effects and how we've all gone through different multi-effects. And I have come back to pedals. And at the moment, I've got a board which has only four pedals on it and nicely spaced out so that I can be pretty sure which pedal I'm on. But I'm even looking at cutting down to three pedals and a smaller box. I mean, I've tried a Digitech Stomp Box unit. And I mean, that is, it's all in the pre-programming, isn't it? If you can set up your favorite three patches with sighted help, then you never need to. If you got into the menu, as soon as I got into the menu, I was stuffed because it raced. You know, if you stomped on the menu button, it went through the presets, you know, faster than my wife could read them, let alone me.
Yeah.
So I would do things like setting up my favorite Marshall sound, my favorite Fender sound, and my favorite whatever other sound, and try to stick to those. But I got fed up not being accurate enough with my feet, so I got a pod, which I had on a mic stand so that I could press buttons with my fingers, which obviously meant I could change settings between songs, but it was a little bit slower to change settings in the middle of a song. I try not to do that, to be perfectly honest. I would like to set up a sound for a song and not have to do anything to the unit in the middle of the song. So exactly as you say, Steve, I've always gone for minimal, and I've given up on the multi-effects. I've used an amp I like and a small number of pedals. So basically, I like to have delay. I like the amp to have a good reverb on it, and then I don't need a reverb pedal. So delay. I like to have distortion, because even if the amp's got distortion, so if you've got a two-channel amp, that's good, because you can switch between your clean and your distorted sound. Yeah. And you can do that on a separate foot switch. So you can have that somewhere where it can't, it's away from your pedals. So I do like that. But equally, I do sometimes like to kick in a different distortion. So, I mean, what you can do is you can have your clean and your mild overdrive on the amp. And then you can, if you want a big overdrive, you can kick that in the pedal. So that gives you three accessible overdrives without worrying too much. I do love compression. I think compression just is magic, sprinkles magic dust. So I would always have compression, distortion, delay. And as I say, I have come back to pedals, because it's a simple on-off switch and nice knobs you can turn, like John was saying about a mixer.
Yeah.
And if I have to, I stick little dots on them. I've always thought what I should really do is get to one of these warehouses that sell you a load of knobs of different, and you know, so I could put chicken head knobs on everything.
Yeah.
Because Marshall knobs, I have to put. I use loads of lock dots. I use dots on the guitar as well, by the way. When I got into artificial harmonics and tapping, and I kept wanting fret markers on my high. So I started off with a little lock dot from the RNIB on my 12th fret on acoustic guitar. On electric guitar, you're looking at 24 frets.
Yeah.
And I thought if I could just have a little dot on fret 12, that would make my life simpler.
And put it between two strings.
I put it on the neck.
Ah.
Just on the side of the neck by the top E string.
Right, right.
And then, so when I was getting into these right-handed techniques, I started putting a dot on the 17th fret. And now I actually have them on, I have lock dots on 12, 15 and 19, and I have a cut up bump on 17. So that's my own little code for where I am. And I mean, you know, maybe it's cheating, but it doesn't half help.
It's not cheating.
On stuff, you know.
If it works, it's not cheating.
Well, I do, say if it works, that's the job, yeah.
I do a version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which has one passage, which is a whole chorus of the song in artificial harmonics.
Wow.
And I would be lost if I didn't have my nice little lock dots and bump-ons to stick on there. And the same, as I say, with a Marshall amp, they're totally circular. You can't tell where you are.
Yeah.
So I've got a lock dot on every damn knob. As I say, the Fender, if you can get a Fender amp with the classic chicken heads, they're brilliant. They were made for blind musicians. So what I really want to do is to buy a load of chicken heads and stick them on the Marshall. But I just need to measure
the shaft. The
little stem. That's the word, shaft, And do that, because there are places that will sell you knobs.
Oh, definitely.
And they're not all pornographic.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm very fortunate on my mixer. All the knobs have a nice strong raised line down the side of them. So that works beautifully.
That's what you want, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've got that on the Soundcrafter like that.
Yeah. And some of them are even twin gang, you know, two knobs on the same spindle, if you like.
Oh, yeah.
And they've both got lines down the side, so you can always tell where they are.
Great. You've been through an effects journey, haven't you, Steve? I think
I've had a number of different things. I've had a Boss delay processor. I've had a Digitech, and they weren't so bad because at that point I could see the screen on them, you know. But
okay,
nowadays, yeah. I mean, there's so many levels of menus to go through. I just don't bother. I've got the effects that I can use on the Soundcraft desk. I've got the effects on the amp because I've got a Boss Katana artist amp, and that's not too bad. But again, even with that, you've got an interface that you can bring up on your computer, and that's completely useless.
I got rather interested today. I was just checking out the latest on the high tech stuff, and I saw there's a thing by Universal Audio called the Aux Amp Top Box, and it has an iPhone app because you know all these new effects units use touch screens, which are hopeless for us.
Yep.
And I thought, hey, iPhone app, could this be an accessible modeler? I'm going to look into that.
Or it could be completely inaccessible.
Could be crap. The trouble with it is, it's a bit of a weird one. It samples your own amp, whereas the others give you, you know, all the classic amp models. What this one does is sort of sample your own amp, so you don't have to carry your big heavy. I love valve amps. And I live up two flights of stairs. So that is a bit of a conundrum.
Keeps you fit.
You want to try these new mini heads that are out. There's a great PRS mini head. It's little, smaller than the size of a shoebox, and it's got some great sounds on it. Incredible.
Sounds good.
It's only about, 20 watts or something like that. 25 watts, but from a valve amp, that's enough for a tiny little venue.
It is, isn't it? Definitely, yeah.
You're absolutely right. You know, a bass player I know who's very, very good. He recently bought, I don't know what make it was, but it looked a bit like a shoebox, as you say, and it didn't weigh much more than a shoebox, to be honest. It was a sort of several hundred watt bass amp. Now, it kicked into proper cabinets, but, you know, I couldn't believe it did anything at all, really, for what it weighed.
Gill and Kruger or something like that. They do a little 500, I think, and it's a 500 watt, and it's the size of a shoebox. And my God, I don't know, I'll kick out some guts.
Probably all these digital amps now, these Class H or whatever they're called. I don't understand the classes anymore. I used to understand them a little bit, but not anymore. Or Class D, anyway. But yeah, I my approach with effects, if people talk about them, it's very simple, really. It's a bit like synthesizers. You buy a synthesizer and it can produce 1,500 sounds and you use about six of them.
Yeah.
And my kind of approach is just to tell people to step back a little bit and just write down what you're actually going to use. And Dave's just said it. He's got delay, he's got distortion, he's got compression. I might add chorus, which is a kind of delay really anyway.
Yeah.
Reverb on the amp, if you're lucky. If not, you might want a reverb pedal. But, you know, really, for most music, what else do you need?
Well, you're right.
And they have these multi-effects units that can do anything at all and, you know, can play the planets and do whatever else, but we can't access them. And, you know, to me, it's just think about what you actually need.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly is music that is very effects driven, isn't it? I mean, you know, U2.
Yeah.
I think The Edge is famous for his pedal collection, isn't he? But I luckily don't go there.
We're being serenaded, aren't we? There's just no need.
Yes. what can we hear?
Yeah, I can hear that. Sounds impressive.
So as far as live goes.
So sorry, guys. Could you hear that?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh. Don't worry. Sounded good, mate.
Great.
But no, I was using the inspiration. That's weird. I've got your mute.
You haven't.
Oh, hang on. I know where it is. I know where it is. My apologies. There's a tiny bit of volume on channel 2. The mic on the far side of the desk there. This must have been picking me up. I should probably mute and solo on the same channel. sorry about that. My apologies.
I mean, I guess one thing I should say is that I'm very lucky that my other half is signed up to what I do and is happy to be driver and roadie. I do know that it's harder for people who don't have that. There's a bass player in Kent who I've worked with, Justin Homewood, who has, well, he's got a certain amount, he's got kind of tunnel vision, but he has a very good setup of a trolley which takes his amp and his guitar, and he goes everywhere by train, except, of course, the trouble is at the end of the gig, he
does there are no trains.
Tends to need a lift, yeah. So, and I've got to admit that we were mostly the people who gave him the lifts, because we know what it's like, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know how long he'd have stayed in the band if it had been down to the band always to give him lifts. But that's partly because he insisted on living in the wilds beyond Ashford, you know, where it's basically him and the Nukes. So, you know, I guess if you live, I think if I were trying to do this, I mean, I live right in the middle of town anyway. And I think if I were having to do this, if Gay finally got fed up with the roadieing and took off with a flute player or a guitarist who could see, you know, I'd be glad that I lived right on top of two railway lines. But I would probably try to work with guys in Maidstone who might just give me a lift. Isn't that appalling? You look on that gigs, on that website I was talking about, kentgigs.com, the standard parrot phrasing is own gear, own transport, which is actually totally discriminatory. So you are, to some extent, needing to find the people who will say, well, okay, my favourite guitarist has got Watson or whatever. You know, there are more of them about than you think. And it's I think it is, if you can find people who live reasonably local to you, and, you know, then it's just down to convincing them of your worth.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure we all have our ways of doing that. And being friendly, because, I do... The thing I noticed, it was funny, actually, the thing I noticed about this guy, Justin, the thing that he and I have in common is we're very mollifying. We're very emollient people. We spend a lot of time saying, oh, fantastic. Yeah, great. No problem. No problem. I can do that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's absolutely okay. And I do know one or two people who are not like that, who do find it harder to get work.
Yeah.
And they're perfectly good players, but they don't press the flesh and slap the backs and be very nice to people. And it does make a big difference when you're dependent on people's goodwill to the extent that we are. But yeah, because, you know, there are times that, and, you know, to be fair to Gyps Gaz, when there's occasions when Gay's off doing something, if, you know, suddenly you set up and then suddenly the organiser says, actually, it's happened to me twice over the summer when we're doing outdoor gigs. We got the gear all set up and the organiser came up and said, oh, can you just move about 6 yards forward from there with your PA and your amplifiers and everything? And Gay wasn't around. And I did find that the band were pretty good about it. It helps if there's a girl in the band. I do find this is a terrible sexist thing to say, but I do find that female band members can, if you do have females in the band, you probably have an easier progress, but not at all universally. That's not, you know, I've said that, and now I think what an idiot I am for saying it, because actually I've worked with some very, very helpful and switched on blokes, so forget I said that.
We'll edit that bit out.
Thank you. Yes.
I don't want to cut you off, Dave. If you because you've been very generous with your time. Do you want to take any more questions if there are any?
If there are any, happy to, but happy to stop if people are desperate to make the tea.
to be honest with you, Dan, I'd just love to hear a little bit of your playing.
Yeah, right.
I wondered if anyone would ask that.
I did too. So, funnily enough, I've got a couple of guitars sitting here with me. I should probably make an appalling bollocks of it, but as I say, I have to be prepared for this. So, there we go. I always find when people ask me to play, I can't think of anything to play. I've actually broken two nails. There is some online. Why don't I play blues? What key should I play?
Now what we need is your version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow now.
Well, this is why I mentioned that I've broken off all my fingers. I'll play a bit without the harmonics.
Would you like me to look after the money?
I can put that online, actually. I'm in a really awkward position on this.
Don't worry.
Yeah, so there we go. My phone running out of juice. Yeah.
That was pretty. Yeah, man.
That was beautiful. I'm afraid that David's phone's going to run out of juice completely, and I would like to wind it up there and say thank you. That was absolutely fascinating. You seem to cover a huge amount, but it was completely organic. It's a really, really great session.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you ever so much.
Yeah.
And we'll be in touch.
Absolutely awesome, dear. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
I've actually done quite a bit, so good stuff.
Thanks all for your contributions as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Thanks again.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dan. Really enjoyed it, and it's nice meeting some fellow pickers.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks again.
Thanks, yeah. Peter.
Pleasure.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you, Peter.
God bless. Bye.
Yeah, nice one, Peter. Thank you, mate. Pleasure. Very good.